Accession number 28657, Mr. Jeff King, Reel 5. Now, we're talking about your time at Dumfries, at the training centre. One thing that's very notable is you, the Polish pilots that were flying you about. Do you have any comments to make about them? What were they like?
Well, in fact, they were excellent pilots, for number one. Some of these chaps, when they came over, had no rank at all, not in the Air Force, and naturally they had to qualify. And I suppose, basically, sending them out on these training schools was one method of bringing them up to scratch. But they were most pleasant chaps, very efficient.
Did they fling you about a bit? I mean, some people have said, from who were at Dumfries, that they used to fling you about in the air a bit, just for fun.
No, I never found that myself. Personally, they were... I found them to be quite... good chaps.
Now, what about the Blackburn Botha? What did you use them for? You were in the Avro Anson's for your bombing and navigational training. Now, about the Blackburn Botha?
The Botha was an all-metal aircraft, twin-engined, which we used for gunnery. It had a mid-upper turret, a very cramped affair too. But these particular aircraft were not suitable for operational use because of the weight. They were so heavy, for one thing, that they couldn't carry a very big bomb load.
Now, what sort of gunnery exercise were you doing? We haven't talked about that.
No. Most of our gunnery exercises were done over the sea. Targets, again, were towed by aircraft, a drogue, air to air, or fixed targets on the sea, floating on the sea, obviously. The air exercises were the most interesting, I must admit. And I did quite well on those.
And which gun were you firing? I mean, was this
a Browning? Yeah.
And were you actually in a turret?
In a turret, yes. Yeah.
And now, tell me about your passing out, or your qualification in this, because you pass out on the 27th of January 1943, so you're there about 3 or 4, 2 months, really.
Yes.
Tell me about the passing out and the exams, because you did really well, didn't you?
Yes. In fact, I did. I came out top in bombing and second in gunnery. My roommate came second in bombing and first in gunnery. So the pair of us both got our commissions direct from the course. That came as a great surprise to me. And in fact, I was on my way to the dining room when the warrant officer in charge of our course came up to me and said, "Young man, you'll be pleased to hear that you've gained your commission." And I could have fallen through the ground.
How did you were pleased, obviously.
I was absolutely delighted. Yeah.
And what about kitting out for a uniform and everything? Because it's not as simple as all that
No. In fact, here again, a stroke of luck, because Ginger Lyons, my friend at the time, his brother-in-law was a chief CID inspector at Scotland Yard and only lived a very short distance from Goodge Street underground station. And there was a military tailor in Goodge Street that Ginger said we could go to get our kit. And so I went to their place in London and stayed there for a few days while I was measured up for all my equipment, eventually going back for a fitting and eventually collecting it. Then on leave until I was called to number 29 OTU.
And did the grant you were given cover the cost of it?
Oh, yes.
So it wasn't a question of digging into your own pocket?
No, somewhere I've got the account, which is absolutely astounding.
You mean how cheap it was?
How cheap it was, yeah. You couldn't buy a decent pair of shoes with that today.
Now, where were you sent to? You get called up to go in March, so you had a fair while off.
Yes, had quite a long leave, which I spent at home, And then I was eventually advised to report to number 29 OTU, North Luffnam.
And what happened when you got there?
Well, on the way up, I was in a compartment. I met a young chap who eventually turned out to be our navigator. We got talking, and then we were billeted in different billets when we got there, to North Luffnam. But the very next day, we were assembled in a hangar, and our crew was formed. Now, I hadn't a clue. I saw Curly, this young chap, standing up beside the wall of the hangar, so I went over, and we were talking, when up came this Canadian, tall young chap, and he said, "Well, you sons of bitches, you're going to be with me." And that's how we met our pilot.
Now, take me through the crew. Let's start with the pilot, because he's... we'll come back to Curly. Now, the pilot was... what rank was he? A flying officer?
He was a flying officer, yeah.
And what his name was George, you said. What was his surname?
George Lang. Yeah, George Lang.
Now, what was he like? Obviously, he was fairly rude. Just tell me what he was like.
He was a terrific personality. Good fun. Good looking, loved the ladies, but one hell of a pilot. He was as cool as a cucumber. Of course, we didn't realise that.
Oh, we'll be coming back to all that, yeah. Now, your navigator was Curly. What was his real name?
Curly. It's disappeared at the moment.
All right, we'll come back to that. And what was he like? He was the first you met. He was a pilot officer.
Yes, the same as myself. He was a very dark, curly-haired young chap. Again, very good-looking. Who, like myself, had obviously passed out as a pilot officer from his course.
So, although he'd got no experience, he was meant to be good. He'd done well.
That's right. He'd obviously passed out well in his course. Yeah.
I've just looked up Curly, and he's Roy Davis, Flight Lieutenant Roy Davis.
I should have known.
You knew him, but you didn't know him as that. You knew him as Curly.
Well,
so,
yeah.
So that's Roy Davis, and he was a good navigator.
He turned out to be a first class navigator.
Now, who else did you meet at that time in that first crew? You've got a navigator and a pilot, and of course you are a bomb aimer.
Bomb aimer, yes.
So your next one's wireless operator.
Wireless operator and rear gunner.
Now, were they wireless operator? Was that a sergeant or that's a
yes,
warrant?
Yes, he was a sergeant at that time. Yes, as was our rear gunner.
So the wireless operator was Sergeant Vincent Day.
Day, yes.
Now, what was he like, as both as a man and as a wireless operator?
He was a Cockney. Terrific personality, good fun, and again, a very experienced chap.
And
in fact, the whole crew, we all gelled, which I think contributed largely to our survival.
Your rear gunner, the first rear gunner you met, was you knew him as Tommy, but his name's Sidney Thomas.
Thomas, yes.
And he's another pilot officer.
That's right. He was commissioned... whilst he was with us, we met him as a sergeant pilot.
So he was originally a sergeant?
A sergeant, yeah.
And what was he like?
Okay, well, he was one of the older members of the crew, typically Welsh. He'd been a foreman at the Rotel Air School Company in Gloucester before he joined the RAF. And again, like myself, I think he was very lucky to escape to get into the RAF.
Now, Did you seem in your... Well, again, we've got drawing on your account, which should be in documents, because you have now given us a copy of it. You seem to have gelled very well with these people. I mean, can you talk... How did you get to know them? I mean, how was it done?
Well, once you were crewed up, of course, you were in each other's company throughout the rest of your time, both in training, and I think during that early time together, we got to know each other very well.
Were you actually living in the same hut? Did they move around?
No. Obviously, those of us who were commissioned were in the officers' mess or in quarter, and the sergeants had their own quarters, of course.
So did you socialise together?
We did.
Outside, obviously you trained together, but you socialised together?
We did. Not an awful lot, but we did, to a point.
Now, the operational training units normally start you on a bomber, and in your case it was the Wellington. It's a medium bomber, isn't it?
That's right.
Now, what was your opinion? Can you tell us a bit about the Wellington, just for someone who doesn't know anything about it, say? Could you just tell us what it was like as an aircraft, what you thought of it?
Well, I'd already had the experience of flying in Wellingtons, of course, from my time as a fitter, and I had every confidence. The construction of the thing being one, of course, which it was designed by Barnes Wallis, the bouncing bomb individual, and it was of a geodetic construction, fabric covered, but it was so reliable. And of course, we had it was a twin engine bomber, Pegasus engines.
Where were the crew stationed within it then?
Well, so you had obviously the pilot's cockpit. As a bomb aimer, I was down in the nose. The wireless operator had his wireless station just slightly behind the navigator's table, which was immediately behind the pilot. There was no mid-upper gunner, of course, because we hadn't at that time picked up a mid-upper gunner. He came later. But the rear gunner, Tommy, he was obviously in his rear turret.
Now, what about, take me through the training program. Firstly, I presume you've just got to get used to flying it. So that was that sort of just a period of flying it?
There was a period of takeoff and landings. Circuits and bumps, we called them.
Now, what circuit? Just explain what circuit. It sounds obvious, but
yes, it was a case of taking off, circling the drome, and landing. Bumps, of course, being what happened is they hit the ground rather hard when they're coming in to land.
And this is really practice for the pilot from the
side. It is. It was completely
in taking off and landing.
Taking off and landing. Yeah.
And where did you move on from that?
Then we moved on to cross-country flying, which involved bombing on various bombing ranges throughout the route. This took place in day and night. Night times, we did normal practice bombing, but we also did the infrared bombing runs on various towns, where the equipment, of course, was located.
And what were these flights like? I mean, how accurate could you get it?
Well, initially, the pilot had an instructor flying with him. It could be from anything from 2 to 3 flights. But George was very, very proficient, and we only had a second pilot fly with us on about 2 flights. Thereafter, we were on our own. These cross countries took 2 to 3 hours, sometimes slightly more, which involved flights around the country, obviously in areas away from London.
And a practice bombing run would be over a set target and done as... how would it be done?
Well, you had ranges which were at certain positions throughout the country, in isolated spots, obviously. And you would do a normal run, as you would on a normal target. You had, of course, practice bombs, and the position that these were dropped were vectored by a ground crew, and these results were passed back to your squadron or training unit after you had done the practice.
Now, something that's mentioned here is searchlight avoidance.
Now,
no one's told me much about searchlight avoidance drills. Is this the corkscrew, or what is this? Or had they not developed the corkscrew then?
No, they hadn't. In fact, it was general evasion. You adopted drills according to whatever they told the skipper. But as you said, the corkscrew had not been evolved to the...
So what would they do, if you got searchlights, how would they practice? What would a searchlight avoidance drill be?
Well, you obviously would dive, first of all, probably either to the port or starboard, and try to evade the beam itself. Sometimes diving down the beam. It just depended on entirely on the pilot.
So it wasn't particularly a set thing at the time, not like the cork, because the corkscrew became a standard avoidance thing, didn't it?
Yes, it did, but that was more of a fighter evasion,
as well as
searchlight. Yeah, but of course, when we got onto operations, the searchlight problem was vastly different.
Would you practice your searchlight avoidance with searchlight batteries on the ground? Because of course they were needed practice.
Yeah.
And how well did you do?
We did quite well. But
now, what about fighter affiliation exercises? I think they're mainly in daytime, aren't they?
That's right. Yes.
How did they work?
Where you would be on a cross-country flight, and at any time you could be mock attacked by usually hurricanes. And again, this is where the evasion came in. And practice for the gunner, and
he wouldn't be shooting real.
No, I was just going to say, his turret would be equipped with a cine camera, as was the front turret as well, where I had practice also.
And how was it? I mean, how accurate were you according to the cine cameras? Because they presumably tell you exactly what's happening.
Exactly. I was going to say, in all cases, we did pretty well. I had a pretty good assessment, and so did Tommy, and, of course, eventually our mid-upper gunner. You were always having practice flights, irrespective of being on an operational station. Practice went right throughout our flying career.
Now, despite the cheery nature of this George Lang, he was quite strict, wasn't he?
He was.
Now, tell us, he made two rules right from the start.
He did. He was a stickler on procedure, and that included general conversation within the plane on the RT. He definitely laid down the rules very severely about how much time you spent talking on the RT.
Is the RT the intercom?
That's the intercom, yeah.
So,
oh yes.
You weren't allowed just to chat on it at all?
Not at all.
Unless you
had something specific to say to any one particular member of the crew.
Something operational?
Precisely, yeah.
And otherwise?
Complete silence. Yeah, there was no chatter.
And the other thing was emergency procedures. I'm not quite sure about that. What were the emergency? I mean, it says full knowledge of all emergency procedures.
Yes. What
were the emergency procedures?
Most of these concerned crash landings, particularly ditching in the sea, positions to take up in the aircraft.
So what would you do?
In point of... you were allocated certain positions in an aircraft in which you took up if there was a prospect of forced landing. That also applied, of course, if there was a possibility of crash landing the aircraft. There were points where you braced yourself.
But they weren't the same.
No. Oh no, they varied aircraft to aircraft. And, of course, we couldn't all crowd into one position. We were allocated certain positions.
Now, so that, now that's the sort of flights you had to do, but you had special training because you had a role almost as an emergency pilot. There was, on this aircraft anyway, and you were practicing on the link training. Now, tell me a bit about the link training, because we're not too familiar with it.
No. Well, the link trainer was the mock-up of an actual aircraft cockpit. This was suspended, and the controls operated precisely the same as they would in an ordinary aircraft. I did so many hours in the link trainer. I did quite well. You went through all the procedure of takeoff, landing, throughout the whole, as you would a normal aircraft. And at the end of the course, you were assessed.
Now, how realistic was it in there?
Very realistic, because if you stalled, you had the exact sensation of coming down in a spiral. So you got the whole works in actual fact. And you felt as if you were going into a hell of a spin.
The idea was just that if something did happen, you'd have a chance of landing.
Have a chance.
This isn't proper pilot's training at all.
No. It was purely a link trainer. But, of course, you went through the full procedure of handling the aircraft and being able to land. You had all the instruments, as you would in a normal aircraft cockpit. And the controls responded exactly the same as they would in an ordinary aircraft.
Now, what about your billets? Because you seem to have moved into Moreton Hall, which is, well, at least the officers did. What was that like? Sounds rather better.
That was an old country manor. It was about half a mile away from the actual drome itself. It was a beautiful place. Obviously, it had been stripped of all its furniture, and it was just equipped with most of beds and bedding and storage cupboards. But it was still a beautiful place. And it was a pity to leave it. I met some very good friends there. One in particular was another young bomb aimer by the name of Bramall. And he...
That's Peter Bramall.
Peter Bramall, yeah. And Peter was a musician. And we used to walk to all the churches in the locality where he'd play the organ, and 9 times out of 10 I'd have to go behind the thing and pump the air bellows. And very often we'd have an audience, but we used to thoroughly enjoy it. He did. I did the pumping.
You couldn't play?
I couldn't play. I often wished I could, but...
He was killed, wasn't he?
He was killed, yes, quite early in his operational.
Now, you had another couple, you said a couple of friends. Is the other one George Kane?
George Kane.
Now, who was he?
Killer Kane. He was another Canadian pilot. Now, he was a wheat farmer from Saskatchewan. And I became great friends with him. And in fact, he was the first pilot I used to take home. He would come home with me on my leaves, but he'd spend most of his time on the farm with my father. He'd get up in the morning at 4:30 and go to work with Dad.
He was obviously missing it.
He was, and he was. He begged me to change crews, but I wouldn't.
And what happened to him?
Well, unfortunately, George went missing on a raid on Leverkusen, and he and the whole crew were killed.
Now, You were same unit, but you moved to Bruntingthorpe in May. Now, what was this about?
Oh, North Lovenham was a grass drome, and so we had to gain runway experience. And of course, Bruntingthorpe was equipped with runways.
Is it tarmac or concrete? I'm never sure.
No, to be quite honest with you, I think they varied. Mostly concrete. Reinforced, of course.
And did it make a difference?
Well, yes, because you were landing in a certain position, central to the runway, and I must admit, we never experienced any difficulty in takeoff and landing. Day and night, there was no problem there.
Now, one thing that is interesting is you saw a strange Lancaster there.
Yes.
And I've never heard of such a thing. Can you tell us as much as you remember about it?
Yes. Well, this, I happened to be walking around the perimeter one day when I couldn't believe my eyes. I saw this Lancaster with two jet engines in the place of the, I think it was the outer engines were jets with a thruster rocket on the underside, with two ordinary Merlin engines on the inner. And this thing was just taking off. But I only saw it on that one occasion.
So did it have just the jet engine? It had two jet engines?
Two jet engines, two outer jet engines, and this thruster rocket.
And did it have the normal inner engine? Because Lancaster's normally four engines.
That's right. It had the two Merlins on the inner as a normal Lang.
In what manner was it flying? Was it flying fast? I mean, was it faster? Was it?
No, it just seemed a bit. Well, I only saw the thing taking off. And, of course, it was most unusual to see this thing with jets roaring away up the runway. And, as I say, that's the only time I ever saw it. And, of course, one realised then that jets were coming in.
Now, was there any final examination? You finished there in June, or was it just, did you have to go through any tests, or was it just you'd passed?
Well, yes, you were assessed again. You had, I should have said earlier that each category had their own leader. There were navigator leader, bomb aimer, gunnery, wireless operators. We all had our individual leaders who were in charge of the course. Because you were briefed as you would normally be on a normal raid by these people. You'd be told your bomb load, where you'd be bombing, and what height you'd be bombing. And on the odd occasion, the individual would fly with you.
Hang on, but like, we're talking about assessment here. That's right. They would assess you.
They would assess, yeah. But of course, in my case, most of the assessing was done by the marking of your bombing details.
And you passed that?
Oh, yes, with no problem.